So, welcome to the lecture on compact star physics. The last time we derived the Schwarzschild metric. And we were looking also at the inertial momentum tensor properties. And now we are in the position to really have a look at the full Einstein equations. As we know now, the right-hand side has to be the inertial momentum tensor. We know its properties. Now let's go back to the left-hand side and couple curved space-time with matter. So the full Einstein equations. So we had space-time is described by the Ricci tensor, R mu nu. And now we know that matter is described by the energy momentum tensor, T mu nu. As you can see, we have now the exact index structure to combine those two equations, and a naive assignment would be immediately, okay, we simply say that space-time tells matter how to move, and matter distorts space-time. So this shall be something like proportional to T mu nu. With a question mark. So with the indices, this seems to be right. Yeah?
Can you maybe turn off those lights? Because you can really read it if the light shines directly onto the screen.
Das hier ausmachen?
Ja. Das ist von der Konstruktion.
Ja, das ist falsch. So ist besser? Ja? Okay, das ist ja merkwürdig. Okay. So you can read this better than before? Kann man das, sieht man das auf dem Video noch? Ja. Okay. So, now if one does this assignment, one discovers one problem. We know that matter is energy momentum conservation. Here we have a conservation, energy momentum conservation, which in curved space-time we argued that the covariant derivative of the energy momentum tensor is equal to zero. Right? But if we do the same exercise now for the Ricci tensor, one finds actually that the covariant derivative of the Ricci tensor is not zero in general, but actually is given by 1/2 times the covariant derivative of g mu nu times the Ricci scalar, and that usually is not equal to zero. I mean, we can argue that with that of course we have metric compatibility, so the covariant derivative of the metric tensor vanishes. So basically means we just have the covariant derivative of the Ricci scalar, but in general, of course, this shall not be zero. Under all circumstances, right, with matter, this cannot be true. So, but this also tells us that we have a certain combination of the Ricci scalar and the Ricci tensor, which we can use, which has a vanishing divergency, so to say. So we can argue now that the covariant derivative of that combination, R mu nu, minus 1/2 g mu nu times the Ricci scalar, is equal to zero. Right? And that quantity is nothing less than g mu nu, the Einstein tensor. And you're going to be asked to prove this relation in the exercises next week. Okay, so we can now make the following setup, that the true Einstein equation in vacuum shall be then g mu nu is equal 8 pi times the gravitational constant times t mu nu. Where we already inserted the coefficient, which turns out to be 8 pi times g, where g is the gravitational constant, just to clarify that. Now maybe there's one question which can arise, and that question is, okay, but before we used actually a different equation. We used r mu nu equals 0 before for vacuum. For vacuum, we used actually r mu nu equals 0. Is this statement equivalent to saying now if I take that Einstein equation and say now the initial momentum tensor is 0, I have no matter, that Einstein equation tells me that actually g mu nu is equal to 0. So thus this corresponds to g mu nu equals 0. I put a question mark here. Yeah. And all we need to show actually is that this works out if the Ricci scalar vanishes in vacuum. Need to show that R is equal to 0 in vacuum. And that's not too difficult to show. Let's see. So let's look at the following quantity. G mu nu times G mu nu is equal G mu nu of R mu nu minus a half G mu nu times G mu nu R. Okay. That one is just the definition of the Ricci scalar, so this is R. And that one here is minus a half, and this one here is just basically the metric times the inverse metric. So this is delta mu mu, so to say, times R. Now here we have the sum over the indices, which basically gives us a 4, right? So this is R minus 2R, so this is minus R. Now if we say that G mu nu is equal to 0, it also implies that R is equal to 0 in vacuum. So this is somehow consistent. So whether we say G mu nu equals to 0 or R mu nu equal to 0, it's equivalent as automatically the Ricci scalar vanishes in vacuum. Good, so Schwarzschild solution is still safe even if we use the other form. So any questions to the Einstein equations? And that factor, of course, you get when we go to the Newtonian limit. Now you have to assume there's some matter distribution or there's some masses orbiting. Then one can get this factor 8 pi g just by having the right Newtonian limit. Good. So let's come to the Tolman-Oppenheimer-Volkoff equation. It's a lengthy name. Three gentlemen are on this name of that equation: Tolman, Oppenheimer, and Volkoff. And maybe that's... Did I make some historical remarks in the introduction about the Tolman-Oppenheimer-Volkoff equation before? Probably not. Pardon me? Don't think so. Okay. So now the story is the following. You find actually different versions of that name in the literature. Sometimes people call it just the Oppenheimer-Volkoff equation. Sometimes they call it then the TOF equation in short. And if people write it out, very often you find that they write it with a U instead of a double F, and all kinds of different versions you can find. It's really amusing. I should make a list of different versions of that equation. Now, Tolman, he was a professor at Caltech in the 1920s and 1930s. Actually, he came from chemistry, but he was then also professor for mathematics and physics. And he wrote a textbook on general relativity, which was published in 1934. And I showed you that one. So, textbook on GR. Nice one. And in that textbook, you can find also, basically, you find the Tolman-Oppenheimer-Volkoff equation there. There are some, the last step somehow is missing, but basically, you find some of the equations I will write down, you find already in that textbook. Now, it happened that Oppenheimer was a professor at Berkeley National Lab at that time, and also associated with the University of Caltech as a professor. And Volkoff was one bright graduate student of Oppenheimer. So he usually takes his graduate students for the summer, or he takes them down to Caltech to work with them. And by that, they were also discussing, of course, in Caltech, with Tolman was discussing with Oppenheimer, and then Volkoff had to do the calculation. So that's the way how it worked, actually. It's still working today. So in the summer somehow of 1939, somehow they assigned Volkoff to calculate actually now the properties of a neutron star. Why? Because in 1932 there was a paper by Landau. Landau said there might be neutron stars. So, and in 1932 Chadwick also discovered a neutron. So they were speculating about maybe there's an object which is composed entirely of this new stuff of neutrons, which is neutral stuff, which is fine for astrophysical fluids. All astrophysical fluids have to be neutral. So this works just fine. So this would be some giant nucleus just built out of neutrons. So they assigned then Volkoff to use the equation of state for a free Fermi gas, which we are going to derive then also in the course of this lecture, and then solve the equations of general relativity. And as they were just taking the equations from the textbook and massage the equations a little bit to put it in a form which is known today as the Tolman-Oppenheimer-Volkoff equation. So in 1939, there appeared a paper by Tolman where he had analytic solutions of the Tolman-Oppenheimer-Volkoff equation by making an ansatz for the metric. And in the follow-up paper right behind it, there was then a paper by Oppenheimer and Volkoff calculating the maximum mass of a neutron star without interactions. Oppenheimer and Volkoff. Numerical solution.
They
did it by hand. So this numerical solution was really derived by hand. This is how at that time they were really solving differential equations and stuff like that numerically. So at that time, graduate students were really working very hard. So they solved really numerically the tough equation on a sheet of papers in hand. The first computers were invented or really were working in 1940, 1941 or something like that. You should read actually the book by Feynman, who discusses actually the Manhattan Project. And they had exactly the same thing when they solved the hydro equation for the atomic bomb. There was a room full of people. They were all sitting there with a pencil and a sheet of paper and were calculating stuff numerically. So this was the computer at that time, a room full of people working on a sheet of paper. Surely you're joking. Surely you're joking, Mr. Feynman. Yeah?
I mean, actually, it was the same in astronomy. Basically, most of the calculations were done by women in the background, basically. But did all the, you know, just by hand.
That's right.
And the whole, like, credit for it was given then by the professors.
Yeah. So it was just said that at that time, actually, the calculations were done by women. And I think also in that case, Feynman mentions that it was a crowd of women actually sitting in a room doing all the numeric simulations at that time. Okay. Good. So for the Tolman and Oppenheimer-Volkoff equation, we use Birkhoff's theorem, which states that any spherical symmetric solution of Einstein equations in vacuum is the Schwarzschild metric. Right? So we are looking now at the interior solutions. So exterior solutions, so let's first. So look at a sphere of fluids. That's actually also the title of some of these references. Spheres of fluids in general relativity. So we look at a sphere of fluids. So we have spherical fluid, we have an interior solution. Which of course depends on the matter, on the stuff here. And we have here the exterior solution. Exterior solution. And for this we know this must be the Schwarzschild solution. The Schwarzschild metric, to be more precise. Later on, we will also discuss the so-called Schwarzschild solution. And that is due to Birkhoff's theorem. Yeah. So we have to derive now the interior solution and match it to the outside solution, exterior solution, which is the Schwarzschild metric. So again, the ansatz for the metric is also for the interior solution, we assume it's a static solution. So there's no time dependence. It's not pulsating. We're just looking at static solutions. So the metric, the ansatz for the metric is exactly the same as we had before for the Schwarzschild metric. So ds squared is minus e to the 2 alpha of r dr squared plus e to the 2 beta of r. This shall be a t, and this is an r squared plus d omega squared from the solid angle. All right. The difference, of course, is now that g mu nu or r mu nu is not zero, but is given with some fluid. And for that fluid, we make the ansatz of having an ideal fluid. Okay, let's write down first the Einstein tensor. So for the Einstein tensor, we also need the Ricci scalar, which I'm not writing down. So probably I'm just writing down g zero zero. Yeah.
So our metric is still static as well, right? Because we have no time dependence in our alpha and beta.
Yeah. We assume it's a static solution. Yeah. In principle, it could be pulsating, right?
Yeah.
that's possible. So G00 is 1 over R squared E to 2 alpha minus beta times 2 R beta prime minus 1 plus E to the 2 beta. Then G11 is equal 1 over R squared 2 R alpha prime plus 1 minus E to the 2 beta. And the last one we need is G22 is R squared E to minus 2 beta alpha double prime plus alpha prime squared minus alpha prime beta prime plus 1 over R alpha prime minus beta prime. And as usual, G33 is equal sine squared times G22. Just from spherical symmetry, it has to be like that. Okay, so now on the right-hand side, we assume we have an ideal fluid. Right-hand side. So T mu nu is just a diagonal matrix with the entry of having energy density, the pressure, which is the same in all three spatial directions. Yeah, so we see actually then G00, this shall here shall be then 8 pi times the energy density. This is 8 pi times the pressure. This is also 8 pi times the pressure, and also this one. Did I miss something?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is the mixed tensor only diagonal?
The mixed tensor is only diagonal. One should be careful with the upper and lower indices, actually, because if I go from upper to lower indices, there is the metric components again enter in there, and therefore one has to be careful.
No,
yeah.
I mean, if both indices are up or down, then only in the mixed tensor I have only energy density and pressure, right?
In the mixed tensor, I only have energy density and pressure?
What do you mean?
Yeah. Anyway, I can write down now the energy momentum tensor with lower indices where the metric enters. So T mu nu is actually E to the 2 alpha times epsilon E to the 2 beta times P R squared times P and R squared sine squared theta times P, and the rest is 0. And you see that this is what you mean with when you have one upper and one lower index here, you mean, with the energy momentum tensor, then basically those metric functions do not appear. That's what you
exactly
were saying?
But then this must be wrong, because when both indices are up, I again have metric functions.
Yeah. Thank you. So I should write it like this. Thanks. Good. So now we can put this into the Einstein equations. And basically, I get then three differential equations. So let's see, how can we massage them? So the next step is we rewrite one metric function for convenience by introducing a mass function, a so-called mass function, M of R. And the purpose is to recover more easily the exterior solution, the Schwarzschild metric, to the outside. Right? So we put beta in a form, so as we can easily see, it goes over to the Schwarzschild metric. So we say that e to the 2 beta of r is equal 1 minus 2g, and then this new function m of r over r to the power of minus 1. Right? Then basically we know that this goes over to 1 minus 2gm over r. And then we can associate it, that metric function m of r, with the mass we see from the outside observer. So this would be for r larger than the radius of the star, yeah, where r is the radius of the star. And that means that m, where r, small r is equal capital R, is then the mass of the star, as measured by an outside observer at asymptotically flat space-time. Right? That's the interpretation. It has to be like that. So how we can, whatever we call that metric function, at the end of the day, when small r is capital R, then this is just the mass which you observe from the outside from the Schwarzschild metric. Good. So now we replace beta of r in one of these equations. Let me see which one. So we put it into the equation, and in fact we put it into this one here. In this equation we put in now this beta e to the, that beta of r is exactly this one. And here we have an e to the 2 alpha minus beta, but you see that this factor drops out with the epsilon there. So the 0,0 component only depends on beta. So 0,0 component depends only on beta of r. So from that we can solve actually for that metric function m of r, and one finds one a surprisingly simple relation. By solving that differential equation, one finds that dm of r over r is equal 4 pi r squared times epsilon from r. Right? Also, now the energy density and the pressure have all radial dependencies, right, as have alpha and beta. I don't write this explicitly. Right, so this is from the 0,0 component. We skip this factor here, and then we put in that beta and beta prime from this one. We get the differential equation for m, and it turns out it's just m prime is 4 pi r squared epsilon of r. So this truly looks like the total energy density content of the neutron star. Basically, we can write this also in integral form, saying that m of r is just given by 4 pi dr r squared epsilon of r, right? like this, or like this. So how much time do I have?
15 minutes.
Hab noch 15 Minuten?
Oh no, it's 5 past.
Now this would be the simple guess. I just integrate over the energy density of the sphere and I get out the total energy, which is just a mass measured from the outside. Energy is m times c squared, so this seems to work just fine. There's one puzzling thing though. We are here working at curved space-time. So the correct integral does not look like that. The correct integral actually looks a little bit different. We forgot the Jacobi determinant, basically, in that integral. And how to resolve that, I can quickly explain, I think, till the end of the lecture. So we can consider that equation actually as the equation of mass conservation. Mass conservation, so to say. And this is similar to the equation we know from the non-relativistic limit. We just put in here, instead of the energy density, we put in the mass density, and then this is just the integral over the mass density gives the mass, right? Mass conservation. Okay. So integral dr r squared is not the proper integral, actually. And why is that? So let's look at the following. To find a proper volume for an integral of curved space-time, let us have a look at a static metric again. We know the metric is really an invariant quantity, and we can rewrite it as ds squared is g mu nu, dx mu, dx nu, right? And in our case, it is equal, I have written it up there. I still have it there. Not really. Okay. So it's e to the 2 beta for static case. So we set dt equal to 0. So this is e to the 2 beta dr squared plus r squared d theta squared plus r squared sine squared theta d phi squared. Okay, let's take the determinant of this one. Determinant of ds squared, or better to say, let's take the determinant of g mu nu dx mu dx nu. Okay, and we know this is the determinant of g mu nu times the determinant of this one. Right? We only have diagonal elements, so basically what we get here is just the product of the dx squared. Right? So we get here. This is, we call the determinant of this one, we call then g. And this one, and actually we have to call it minus g because of the minus sign, because of our metric convention. This will be always negative, so to have a positive quantity, I'm sorry, to have a positive quantity, we rewrite it as minus g later on. So this is the square root of minus g dr d theta d phi squared. Yeah, and this is equal then e to beta r squared sine theta dr d theta d phi squared. Okay, so here we recover actually the correct expression for the for an integral in spherical coordinates, but now we see also an additional term is entering here, e to beta is entering here, the metric function of the 1-1 component. So the proper integral actually is then, which we call m bar, is then given by 4 pi dr r squared e to 2 beta times the energy density. And I shall put in a prime here. Okay. Which then is written out of 4 pi dr r squared of 1 minus 2 g m of r prime over r prime to minus 1 times epsilon of r prime.
What happened to r squared? I have an r squared, actually have an r cubed in my determinant, but I also have an r squared in my in the equation recovered from the Einstein-Fried equation.
Where's an r squared?
In the determinant.
Here?
Is an r squared. This whole expression is squared.
Yeah.
So I have an r cubed.
Yeah, yeah. This is r to the fourth power.
And I also, in the equation for m of r, I also have an r squared.
Yeah, yeah. You see, one usually I have this integral dr times d theta d phi. So this dr, this d theta d phi gives the 4 pi. And the dr times r squared comes from this one here. So if I put beta equal to 0, then this would be the proper integral measure to put in here for this integral, and then I get this expression. So what I have done now, that I have replaced that integral, which just combined corresponds to this expression here, to the full one. So I included also e to the 2 beta in the expression, which is the correct expression for having a proper integral. You see that this actually is always smaller than m, because this factor here, if you go down here, is, no, the other way around. This factor is always larger than this. This is always smaller than 1. I take the inverse, so this is always a factor larger than 1, actually. So always this one is larger or equal the mass of the star, m, which we just calculated. So now it's clear somehow what we have here. So if we look at the difference between m bar, which is the proper integral, and m, which is measured from an outside observer, what is the mass of the object, the difference is just the binding energy, the gravitational binding energy of that fluid of sphere. This is what is entering here. Yeah. So when we measure the mass from the outside, it already takes into account the gravitational binding energy. This is why we have that form and not that form. We will define also another mass when we discuss neutron stars, when it comes to some conserved quantum number. Then we can define also conserved number density, and from that we can conserve a conserved number of particles. And if we multiply that with the vacuum mass, we get also a corresponding mass, which have to be replaced with m bar. And then the difference between the number of particles times the vacuum mass minus the true mass measured from the outside, the capital M, which I haven't really defined here. So the integral of that one gives then the binding energy. And the one thing, if we just integrate over all particles, would be then the baryonic mass of the star, if we talk about a quantum number of baryon number. I shall also write down here, this is then capital M is then the integral up to R equal capital R is then 4 pi dr prime r prime squared epsilon of r prime when I calculate the integral from 0 to r. Okay, so this m of r actually has an upper integration which goes to r from 0 to r, to be more precise. 0 to r, 0 to r. Okay, I think now it's correct. So any questions to this one? Okay, so we just have derived the mass conservation differential equation. We can define actually capital M when we integrate up to the radius of the star as the mass measured from an outside observer. And we have seen that when we calculated properly the m bar, we see that it just takes into account gravitational binding energy or the curvature of space-time. Okay, so I close the lecture. If there are no further questions, and then we see each other next Tuesday.